Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive as we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but I have no fear you will be safely traveling with us. We appreciate you showing up here each week at X Squared Radio. This is where we go deep into the mysteries, talk about all kinds of things in the news, and sometimes we make the news or lead the news here, and this is a live call-in program, so you can always join us by calling toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. And if you need to duck out and listen to the program on your cell phone, you can do that as well by dialing 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and the passcode is 769-608-POUND. We appreciate the debut of Senator Michael D. Brown from Washington, D.C., being on right before us. He did a fantastic job on X Squared Radio last week. We support his cause of bringing Washington, D.C. in as the 51st state. Glad he did an excellent job tonight. Good job, Michael. All right, the solar wind tonight is cooking at 459 kilometers per second, and there are seven sunspot clusters on the sun today. In November 2013, I think you're well aware now that Comet Ison should become one of the biggest and brightest, most active comets in years when it races through the hot atmosphere of the sun. Right now, though, it's just a dim speck in the deep freeze of space near the orbit of Jupiter. By the way, tonight, I think we got pretty clear skies most everywhere. Check out Jupiter and the crescent moon tonight. They'll be aligned. Spectacular. It was gorgeous last night, although Jupiter was a little bit higher than the moon after sundown. A coronal mass ejection swept past Earth yesterday. The impact rattled Earth's magnetic field. And by the way, it generated electrical currents in the ground around the Arctic Circle. Really spectacular. It was measured. So we have a lot of sunspots up there, but nothing really active, nothing really to fear, although we have a few gun barrels pointed at us. Very, very low chance of anything major happening on the grid. Now, we're going to cover a lot of subjects tonight. One of the things that's been fascinating, I mean really fascinating of late, is the economic science of how the global economy is being affected, how it's being manipulated. We're going to cover a lot of those aspects tonight so that you can understand it, know how to position yourself, maybe position your small business, and get yourself ready for the holidays that may be coming and the coming bank collapse. Distrust of the Federal Reserve. This is an article by Amanda Crawford that came out. We tried to interview Amanda. This is Reuters. We tried to interview Amanda about this article, but she, her boss would not allow her to come on and make a comment. So we're going to comment about her article, and hopefully you give her some positive feedback. So if you go to Reuters, click on Amanda's email and send her a message that you at least heard her article and were inspired by it. Distrust of the Federal Reserve and concern that U.S. dollars may actually become worthless are fueling a push in more than a dozen states to recognize gold and silver coins as legal tender. Now, this is kind of a slippery slope here because, yes, they're talking about legal U.S. tender, not Krugerrands or any of the other, you know, gold and silver coins that are out there, just U.S. legal tender minted by the U.S. Mint, which, by the way, are not pure silver. Silver Eagle is 31.1 grams of silver and about 4.9 grams of copper. Copper stabilizes the silver, makes it better for legal tender. So just so you know, it's not pure silver. But it is a slippery slope because obviously they're not using the $1 face value of the Golden Eagle. They're using the silver value of the Silver Eagle. I'm sorry, I said Golden Eagle, Silver Eagle. And currently the face value of silver is just under $27 an ounce. It's actually slipped another $1.50 in one day this week. And that's just because of the efforts of the short traders. There's plenty of silver that's trading out there. And if you're in the market to convert cash into silver, I highly recommend that you do so. It's a great price. So you have, for all intents and purposes, a $27 $1 coin. And if you take your silver to the Utah Gold and Silver Depository, that value is going to be given to you on a debit card, which you can use for specific purposes only. Lawmakers in Arizona are poised to follow Utah, which authorized this bullion for currency in 2011. Similar bills are advancing in Kansas, South Carolina, and other states. In Utah, officials haven't yet figured out how to accept gold and silver for tax payments, but they're working on it because there are a lot of residents that want to pay that way. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has pushed interest rates to near zero since the 18-month recession that began December of 2007. Most people, myself included, believe that we are not out of that recession yet. We never turned the corner. We might have hit a flat spot where it wasn't going down anymore, but I think we have double and even triple dipped into that recession. And it's only been a cooperative press that has kept you from knowing about it. The Utah Precious Metals Association established after passage of the 2011 law to advocate for the use of gold and silver coins has established a pilot program in which members of that depository, I'm sorry, of that association, can make deposits that are held in gold and access money using a bill pay service, very similar to the bill pay that's used on your bank, but only certain things can be paid. The measures backed by the limited government Tea Party movement are mostly symbolic, although they are significant and they are setting up some precedents. You still can't pay for groceries or gasoline with gold in Utah, but that day is not far away, you mark my words. Hey, before we get going too much further, we already have a call. Let's bring Jake on from Florida, line two. Welcome to the program, Jake.
Yes, sir. Hi. I am the person that called you about a month ago regarding Dr. Fred Bell and his relationship to, like, fighting terrorism and stuff like that.
Yes.
And your radio show just kind of, like, ended and never came back on that day.
Yeah, well, it was kind of strange. You know how your computer decides to go through its software update? Well, mine didn't do that, and the studios didn't do that, but the servers did that. and there was nothing we could do to stop it. So let's continue with that discussion.
But, yeah, I did want to ask you, though, sir, I was trying to get that footage or that radio interview off of your website, and I actually tried not once, not twice, but three times with three separate credit cards, and it's not letting me pay for – well, I think it actually did let me pay with two, and it put it into your account, but it's not letting me actual sign in with my name that I should have gotten with two credit card payments and two names. You see what I'm saying?
Well, that's interesting.
Sorry to have to hassle you like this, man, but I'm just wondering, like, what's going on?
If you'd have sent me an email, I would have fixed that in, like, 1 minute. We did have
some...
Well,
I thought I did. I thought I did. Actually, I think it might have been just the staff or something. It was right on you guys' website, sir, and I clicked on
BBS
some sort of staff button to...
Were you on bbsradio.com or are you on X Squared Radio?
No, I was on you guys' actual website.
Well, X Squared Radio?
Yes, sir.
Well, I usually fix those within 30 minutes of people writing me. So you wrote to bagnew@x2-radio.com. I guarantee you that it's just a pass.
I'll tell you what. Let me write that down. I know I wrote to somebody official. You know, I don't know what they do. But, yeah, let me go ahead and write that down, sir, if you don't mind.
bagnew@x2-radio.com.
Well, let me get a pen here. I'm sorry. Now I got my pen.
All right, that's a manual word processor. bagnew@x2-radio.com. Just write me and your email. I'll look it up and find out what the problem is. Sometimes our member management software does some odd things with people trying to log in, but we have about 800 people that.
Well, I'll tell you what, you kind of threw me off. Did you say I said a banned word? I'm having trouble hearing through my phone.
No, it's a member management software that we have.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it has
your
a hard
email,
time.
Your email was kind of cutting out. My phone is not so great. I got bagnew@x2-radio.com. x2-radio.com. Okay, now I heard you. Okay, but yes, sir, I mean, if you wanted to continue that conversation, but real quick, though, I guess I'll just send you a letter there and you'll refund the money or you'll just, like, let me log in. I'd prefer to be able to log in so I could download that show.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, we want you to be a listener. Yeah, well, we'll fix it in 30 minutes, not while I'm live because I can't talk and manipulate that at the same time, but right after the program, I'll take care of it.
But, yeah, I mean, I got the impression right then that perhaps that is something that should not be talked about, or what do you think, like national?
I think it was just a coincidence. The server company did not notify the studio that they were going to reboot the server. So the whole Channel 2 went down, and there wasn't anything anybody could do about it. Now, I continued to record, but the station was down, and we were off the air. So that whole three-hour archive is still on our website, but it's not on BBS Radio.
Right. Okay. Makes sense.
So what would you like to know about Dr. Fred Bell, the great and powerful...
Oh, well, you know, if we're allowed to talk about it and your radio show doesn't, you know, conveniently shut off again. But, you know, I actually just had a big, serious question that's actually easily answerable. I was listening to some of his old work, and he was talking about, you know, fighting terrorism, and he would talk about how the key to fighting terrorism is raising people's consciousnesses, and he would get all into, like, crystals and all type of that stuff, like really high-tech stuff. And I was just wondering what you knew about the particular devices that he uses and how they could sort of interface with how we fight terrorism today in America. Because I know some of them just off of his website, and they're really, really high-tech. Again, though, this is public information, but they are really high-tech. The guy's, I guess, like a genius inventor, right?
Well, the late Fred Bell was a great genius inventor, no question about that. He and his technology is more about absorbing the negative energy that is around people and only constructively interfering with the positive energy. So basically the area around you, and you can even get these for your home, I think, will be bathed in only positive energy. All the negative energy that comes in from all kinds of radio waves and scalar waves and all that are all destructively interfered with, and they don't resonate around you. So that was the basis of his technology. And I'm told the people that wear those pendants or have them, you know, around their prayer places in their house, really, really swear by them. They do work.
I tried one personally.
Yeah, absolutely. You can wear one around your neck, or you can get a little larger one. I think he had one that was almost 6 feet in diameter that he built down there in Balboa. And when he fired it up, it did some really strange things in the neighborhood. They had to finally turn it off.
What about the holographic projector? Now, based on what I heard, it can actually project a holograph. But it can also, according to Dr. Bell, is if you sit it, you know, at a place where you sit and think a lot, like, for example, a desk or an office, and you're just sitting there thinking, you can actually physically manifest reality and basically create anything you want with that type of device, because it somehow interfaces with your brain's network and just makes stuff happen. So I don't know if you heard about that, but it's called the holographic projector.
I haven't heard about that one. I didn't get a chance to speak to Dr. Bell about that one, but it sounds like an interesting idea.
Yeah,
I pity anything that tries to interface with my brain's network.
What's that?
I pity anything that would try to interface with my brain's network.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it would have to be bolted down from 10 different directions.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an opinion, but he is like the great nephew of Alexander Graham Bell. So, you know, you got some credible people that just run in his family. I'm certainly going to go ahead and try, you know, and test some of the things that he uses. He's also got like a head pyramid that you can actually wear, and it's actually based off of the Egyptian pyramids, sort of like on an energetic level. And you put those things on your head, and according to him, if you have any amalgam fillings or something like that, they will actually fall out of your teeth. You won't even have to.
Oh, I wouldn't want that because I have plenty of those.
Yeah, you know what? That's what I was thinking. That's one of the things I want to ask the people you order that stuff from. Do you have to have somebody on standby, you know, like as they fall off? But I'll tell you what, those things are sure just dangerous in their own right, you know? I don't know if you know too much about amalgam.
I've heard that if you have a propensity for any sclerotic diseases, that the amalgam in the fillings can exacerbate that.
Oh, okay. So just on a case-by-case basis, you're saying that, okay. Yeah, I've heard more than that. I heard that it could do a lot more than that. Whether it's theory or not, I don't really know for sure. I'm certainly no doctor, but I would be willing to certainly get mine out. What happens with that, like I said, I don't know if you need a doctor on standby when he actually pops out of there, or how that would work, or hopefully, you know, you wouldn't be sleeping and you're wearing the thing, and you swallow it. That'd probably be a worst-case scenario. So,
I think it would take a lot to get the fillings out of your teeth.
I agree. Well, I'll tell you what, this thing's supposed to detoxify your whole skull. So, I don't know, like I said, I'm going to give this stuff a try. But, all right, sir, thank you for taking care of that sort of like financial issue, I guess we could call it, right?
No problem. Just write me at that email address, and I'll have your email address then, and then we'll go in, and I'll fix your username and password if that's the issue, and we'll get those archives to you. No problem.
Okay. All right. That sounds great. Appreciate it, man. Have a good night.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
All right, Earth Explorers. Continuing on with our story, as the limited government Tea Party has been applying pressure to the states to at least provide some kind of hedge for the average voter, the average consumer, so that they don't have to have large amounts of cash laying around, cash value of which the federal government's recent actions is devaluing on a daily basis. They might as well be walking into your bank account and hauling out to your value at 10% at a time. The various states' legislators are all about signaling discontent with the monetary policy of the federal government and about what Ben Bernanke is doing. There is a fear out there that the government, or Bernanke in particular, and the Federal Reserve, is pursuing a policy that will lead to the collapse of the dollar. That's what's behind it. That's what's driving this. Bernanke has pushed interest rates to near zero since the 18-month recession began in 2007. As I said, I don't think that it has slowed down. Well, maybe it flattened out a couple times, but it's certainly taken a couple of dips since then. The Fed said in March it would continue buying $85 billion in securities each month in a program known as quantitative easing. That's a really fancy way of saying that they're inflating dollars and taking away your value. It has ballooned its assets beyond $3 trillion and is aiming at keeping long-term borrowing costs low to support economic growth. Well, you can't keep them much lower than zero. And, of course, there's a ramification when you lower interest rates that far. It discourages people from putting their money into the bank in the form of savings because it doesn't pay any interest. So if the bank has no or very little depositors' money in there, then the bank cannot leverage that money and thus meet the credit needs of their community. So it's a two-edged sword. Consumer prices rose only 1.3% in February from a year earlier, according to an inflation measure favored by the Fed, and that was below the central bank's 2% target and compares with occasional bouts of more than 10% increases in the 1970s and early 1980s. Now, that's growth. Bets that inflation would pick up because of economic stimulus measures helped fuel a 78% jump in gold since December of 2008. That has since slid. The dollar's rise to less than 1% below a one-year high set in July, and monthly increases of about 2% or less in the U.S. Consumer Price Index have curbed demand for bullion. And since reaching a record of about, $1,920 or so, it's now down to about $1,575, and it actually bounced off of $1,539, and a lot of people are thinking it could go down in the $1,200 and $1,300 range. In Texas, lawmakers are considering a measure supported by Governor Rick Perry to establish the Texas Bullion Depository to store gold bars valued at about $1 billion and held in a New York bank warehouse. That would be J.P. Morgan Stanley. So when we have an effort by states, at least the legislators or the leadership of the states, to move gold from the New York depository, which they get paid for each month for housing that gold, and they also are able to use that gold for long and short wagers, shall we say, by investors. When states make a move to take that money out of the vaults, it takes the bank, which in this case would be J.P. Morgan Stanley, out of that speculative business and puts the state in control of its own asset. $1 billion in gold is owned by the University of Texas Investment Management Company, or UTIMCO, which took delivery of 6,643 bars of the precious metal in 2011 amid concern that demand for it would overwhelm supply. The proposed facility would also accept deposits from the public and would provide a basis for a payments system in the state in the event of a system dislocation in a national and international financial system. That's a really nice way of saying a major bank holiday, a major system breakdown, the inability of cash to be able to move from state to state or from country to country. This would be covered by gold medal, which would be in the possession of the state. Should Texas take this step, it would offer sovereign banking for deposits and make buying and storing gold easier. This is a major move toward, I'm not going to call it separation, I'm not going to call it secession, I'm not going to call it a thumb in the eye of sovereignty against the federal government, but it is a definite statement of mistrust. And when a state with the economy, and by the way, Texas, I think, has the 11th largest economy in the world, it is a huge, huge conglomerate in and of itself, not only having tremendous oil reserves, but other minerals. It is a rail headquarters. It is an import-export headquarters. It has tremendous amounts of technology in the state. And since it has income tax, it has been a hub and a leader of business growth in the last 20 years. It's been really unbelievable to watch the difference between the growth of small business and its success in the state of Texas compared to other states like California. The measures that Texas is taking give people the option of using money that won't lose any purchasing power to inflation. A lot of people don't know this, but or they don't realize this, that gold will buy the same amount of land today as it did in 1875. The gold, it does not change in value. It is the dollar that changes in value. So when you see gold go up to $2,000 per ounce, that means that the dollars are worth less. When the value of gold goes down to $1,500, then the dollars are worth more. But the gold, relative to hard goods and its value, never changes. So the Washington-based public policy group supports the step as a return to the gold standard, which pegged the dollar's value to bullion. If you remember, Nixon formally ended the convertibility of U.S. currency to the precious metal in 1971, and it exactly coincides with the runaway printing by the Fed of dollars, having nothing to back it. People in these states find the idea of having the option to use hard currencies appealing over the policies for which they have no control. The U.S. Constitution bars states from actually coining money. It also forbids them from making anything except gold and silver coin tender for paying debts, but that could change. Advocates say that opens the door for the states to allow bullion as legal tender. The measure being considered in South Carolina would recognize foreign or domestic minted coins as legal tender, in which you would see the Kruger Rand and other fixed weight coins to be used as legal tender, because it is actually the value of the metal, not the monetary value on that coin, that is being used as the basis of value. Utah's law applies only to U.S. minted coins, and the other states are a little less clear on whether privately produced coins qualify. In other words, hand-poured 99.9% pure silver bars, which are out there, and you can buy them on eBay, or you can buy them at Apmex. That's where I buy my coin, my bars. And by the way, they usually have a really, really good price on silver eagles as well. Many of the silver sites that you see advertised on TV do not send you the coin. The coin is held by a depositor. You only hold a certificate that says you have the coin. I highly recommend against that, unless you're going to be trading back and forth, doing rapid trading. Get the coin in your hand. I buy 1 ounce bars, I buy 5 ounce bars, and occasionally 10 ounce bars, not of gold, obviously. To me, they're easy to handle, easy to store, and they're absolutely pure, 99.99% pure, and they're beautiful. The measure being considered in South Carolina would recognize also stuff that's not minted in this country. And I think other states are going to follow that. Arizona leaves the door open, by the way, for private coins if they are declared legal by a non-appealable court order. Still, I told you, it's a slippery slope. It's happening. When states start making moves to allow people to recognize another form of value, and many states, now 12, are doing this, it is definitely a thumb in the eye of the faith and credit of the United States of America. In Utah and some other states, the measures also eliminate state capital gains or other taxes on the coins. In other words, if you deposit the coins with the various state depositories, and say silver is worth $27.50 an ounce, and we have the silver accident occur and silver goes to $100 an ounce, now your coins are and your deposit in the depository is worth four times as much. Ordinarily, when you're speculating on currency, there's a 25% capital gains tax on that. But in the case of precious metals, states can eliminate the capital gains tax on the metals in order to encourage the deposits and provide the depository with a basis for its value. Critics say the state measures are unwieldy, but they're not. It only takes a little bit of programming, and you can put algorithms in there to stabilize it so that it's not jumping all over the place minute by minute. As I said, silver changed $1.50 in one day this last week, and that, of course, is volatility, but it can be evened out. In Arizona, Senator Steve Farley, who's a Democrat, unsuccessfully offered an amendment that would have recognized as legal tender other state commodities such as citrus fruit, pork bellies, sunbeams. You know, the amendment was intended to reflect the absurdity of the bill, said the 50-year-old lawmaker from Tucson. He was horse-laughed out of the place. It is simply grandstanding to get people afraid that somehow President Obama's agenda is going to drive us into hyperinflation and economic collapse, which it will. We have enough real problems to deal with. I don't see undercutting our entire financial structure as a priority, said Farley, who is pretty much out to lunch. In Utah, officials haven't yet figured out how to accept gold and silver for tax payments, although, as I said, the residents are pressing for it, and it will go into effect not this year, but almost certainly will go into effect next year. Richard Ellis, who's the state treasurer, is for it. Lawmakers have established a task force to study implementing the law and to examine how the state can accept gold and silver with their fluctuating values for payment. The nice thing about gold and silver is that the value fluctuates up and down, whereas the American dollar only fluctuates down. It can only go down because the Fed is printing $85 billion worth of magic money every month. And of course, you and I don't see that. That's injected at very high levels directly into the credit markets, hence the record-breaking Dow value, or shall I say Dow number, and you never get to see that. It never trickles down to you. For, talk about trickle down, forget about it. It doesn't even get close. These are high-level, high-dollar, primary credit markets where this money is going in. These securities that are being bought are practically worthless when they're bought in this manner. Now, when China comes in and puts their money in to buy the securities, that's real money. Even though we call them a currency manipulator, I would say look who's calling the kettle black. When Japan or Germany, sometimes the EU comes in and buys U.S. securities as well, that's real value coming in. But when the Fed buys it, it's just like printing monopoly money to buy property on the board. The money doesn't exist. The numbers are worthless. You're generating money to buy something that already is part of your system. Now, people point to Utah and they say they're leading the way, but nothing much has happened because regulatory hurdles have got in the way. The federal government, there we go. Good observation, by the way. The shadow government, which is made of the departments, bureaus, administrations, and agencies, are the ones that are piling the regulations in place. Congress has nothing to do with this. The regulations that are being put in place by the hundreds each month are being written by bureaucrats. They tax you, they fine you, they seize your property, they incarcerate you, they litigate you, and they do it in a very meticulous and engineered way to set precedents so that they can march forward with their agenda, which is led by none other than the executive branch. Hence the complete, total imbalance of the powers of government. There is no balance. It all rests with the executive branch. In fact, as Senator Michael Brown admitted on the program last week, Congress is forbidden by law from communicating directly with the agencies unless they bring the agencies into a hearing in Congress. It is illegal for Congress to call up the agencies, especially with a constituent, and say, what the heck is going on? That is illegal. You cannot do it. It's a violation of law. Well, it's a violation of regulations, which have the force of law. That's what's getting in the way. If gold and silver is being used in the state as legal tender, it is probably only in transactions between individuals, he said, not between the state and people. The Utah Precious Metals Association, established after passage of the 2011 law to advocate for the use of gold and silver coins, has about 24 members enrolled in a two-month-old bill pay service in which their accounts are held in gold. And that amount, that number of people is growing. It's growing on a weekly basis. Now, there are gold producers. The Arizona measure, sponsored by Republicans, won preliminary approval in the House of Representatives April 4th, just a few days ago, after passing the Senate on a party line vote on February 28th. Gold is actually mined in a huge way in both Arizona and Utah. Now, some of these mines are, you know, like you would think a gold mine would be, you know, with tunnels and rail and all that. But in Arizona, most of the gold is what we call placer gold. This is where you take a scraper, you know, one of those big, heavy yellow equipment things that you see where it has two big wheels in the front, where it kind of splits in half and steers left and right. That's a scraper. What happens is the scraper drives along and scoops up about 4 or 5 inches of soil until that pan is full, and then that conveyors over into a dump truck. The dump truck, carrying about anywhere from 10 to 12 yards of dirt, drives over to an input to a sluice. It dumps that dirt. That dirt is then processed through a sluice, some of it water, some of it chemical. And the gold is extracted. Now, out of each ton of dirt that's scraped up in Arizona, you can expect between a quarter and about 1.5 ounces of gold. That is a huge amount of gold because you're moving about 100,000 yards of dirt a week through this system. So you can see that's a tremendous amount of gold that's recovered in Arizona. And many of these mines, although the claims have been staked for a long time, 50 years some of them, they haven't been mined yet because it takes a lot of money, first of all, to put the equipment together. You got to get the geology reports. Some of people have to borrow the money to begin the mining. And if they have the claim, they don't have the money to start the mining. And, of course, as you know, there's no money to borrow in the United States. So only existing gold miners, active gold miners that have active cash flow and 50, 60, 70,000 ounces of gold in reserve can actually buy the time with the equipment to actually make the business run, because there's a little bit of a time lag. And in this day and age, it's all about cash flow. If you run out of cash before you start yielding the gold and getting revenue from the gold, you're out of business and you lose your mind. So a lot of that stuff is just speculated on. There are 100,000 ounces in the ground, or there's 1 million ounces in the ground, and this is what they gamble back and forth and sell to different investors and sometimes foreign corporations or LLCs to trade the stock rather than trade the gold that's actually mined. So Utah and Arizona and Nevada are the largest U.S. producers, according to the National Mining Association figures. There are also mines in Montana, although these are rock mines and not necessarily placer mines. And there are lots of mines up in Canada and even Alaska, although you only get about 2 to 3 months a year when that gold is accessible, because the rest of the year it's just too darn inclement up there and equipment breaks when it gets that cold. Plus, how many people feel like camping year-round? You just don't. It's too hard on people. So the bill's sponsor, who's Senator Chester Crandall, he's 66 and he's from Heber, Utah, he is convinced the move is the logical thing for the state of Arizona to do. And as a gold producer, that's exactly what they're going to do. He says, I think you look at some of the things that are happening and the amount of money printed by the Federal Reserve, who has lost control of that money, and I think anybody would be concerned. Gold and silver have been around a long time, probably about 4.5 billion years, and people are secure with it, and we should give them an opportunity to use it. So it's a great article, and I make no apologies for the commentary. If you want to get with Amanda and commend her for this fine report, with she's with Bloomberg, and you can write her. Just go to Bloomberg and look up Amanda Crawford, and you can write her on this article. Good job. Also in the news, as we round out this hour, you know, there's a Dutch company. I know you've heard this from time to time. We'll keep you posted on it. There's a Dutch company offering one-way tickets to Mars. It's called Mars One. It's looking for volunteer astronauts to participate in the first manned mission to Mars. The company wants to send 4 people to the Red Planet to start a colony. They must be very good bridge players. I added that part. And they'll be taking off in 2023, although there is one catch. You'll have no way of coming back. Sorry, just only enough money to get you one way. Now, that being said, they're going to send supplies up there so that a actual town can be built. Yes, it's pretty inclement. Although there's a possibility with the coming comet Ison that the weather might be changing quite a bit. We'll see. I got a little bit of audio. I'd like to play that for you just to let you know how it's coming out with this Dutch company. Kind of interesting stuff.
German flight instructor Stefan Günther loves his wife Bayota, but he's prepared to say goodbye to her forever. The father of 3 hopes to be one of 4 volunteers chosen by TV viewers to travel to Mars.
I'm healthy, physically and mentally fit. I'm ready to go. What's not clear to me yet, of course, is what the whole selection process is going to look like. It depends on many factors, but I hope my chances are good.
Dutch startup firm Mars One want to raise the $6 billion required for a manned mission to the Red Planet by selling global broadcasting rights for the trip and its aftermath. Viewers will choose the winning contestants. Co-founder Bas Lansdorp says the plan is deadly serious.
Everything we need to go to Mars exists. We have the rockets to send people to Mars. We have the equipment to land. on Mars. We have robotics to prepare the settlement for humans. So for a one-way mission, all the technology exists.
Humans have never flown to Mars for one simple reason. There's no way of getting back. That's why British Mars expert Dr. Adam Baker of Kingston University thinks the plan is unlikely to come to fruition.
To send people there with life support, with food, with air, with all the other things that they'll need, books, entertainment, means of communication, and means of providing for their own resources for a long stay on Mars, that's even more challenging. The sheer size of the rockets you'd need to do this would be absolutely colossal.
But if it does happen, what does Gunther's wife, Beata, think about her husband leaving his family to see out his life in a cold desert world millions of kilometres away?
I wasn't really involved in the decision. We talked about it and I wasn't really amazed and saying, woohoo, you're flying to Mars and maybe you won't come back. I wasn't overwhelmed with joy.
Skeptics doubt the world's authorities will allow the project to dump people on a faraway planet with no way home. Yet the Mars One team says they are going ahead with planning an unmanned supply mission for 2016, followed 2 years later by a robotic rover designed to build the settlement. The volunteer astronauts would land in 2023, with uninterrupted video transmission following every move of their new life on Mars.
Well, there you have it. So Mars One, individual group that wants to send someone one way to Mars. Actually, I think this guy should probably stay. You know, his three kids probably need him. I could think of two or three other people that probably really do need a one-way trip to Mars or somewhere. Also, while we're talking about the economy, somebody brought up the prospect of the Bitcoin to me. And I decided to do a little bit of research. I admittedly don't know much about it, but I'm going to cover the Time magazine story here and then a little bit of commentary. I think it's interesting. Our phone lines are open, by the way, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-9537. And you can also send me Skype messages. I'm at X2-radio. The Bitcoin is an interesting creation because it is a virtual currency. Not really surprising, is it? We have a virtual currency today, although some of you, maybe not all of you, have some representation of that currency in your pocket in the form of something green and gray and made out of paper. So, yeah, the volatile rise and fall of bitcoins has prompted lots of stories explaining why the online virtual currency is a classic bubble. Many compare it to tulip mania in the 17th century Holland, where the prices of rare tulip bulbs soared to absurd heights and then crashed, ruining the speculative investors who had bought them. But the Bitcoin phenomenon is more than a bubble. It says something important about the current and future state of the global economy. We have often talked on this program and have mentioned in the Amazon best-selling series called The Arc of Millions of Years, my co-author and I wrote about 2,000 pages about the origin and destiny of the Earth and its peoples relative to the 2012 end times. In that book, many, many civilizations have wrestled with the idea of some kind of currency, some kind of exchange for value from one place to another, from one country to another, from one time to another. And typically coins have been used, and of late, the last 1,000 years or so, paper has been used. So now we have a much more fluid, a much more dynamic, a much more real-time economy, whether you're buying something in China or the UK over eBay, or whether you are selling a bottle of wine in Greece to a person in Argentina. The commerce is instantaneous, And the requirement or the need for a liquid currency that can be flashed in an instant around the world and maintain its value without getting beat up too bad in the exchange is necessary. It's become of age. Now, we've had some stuff. We've had, you know, Bill Pay, and we've had now PayPal, which many people are familiar with. Many people have small businesses that run with a PayPal account. However, there are still some very, very large merchants that refuse to take PayPal. For instance, you can't buy a thing on Amazon with PayPal. Amazon refuses to recognize any transaction from PayPal. So that's the interesting thing. That's the challenge that we have. What kind of currency? Now, we've been using credit cards and debit cards and things like that, but that can also be rather lethargic. Plus, as you know, the debit card companies and the credit card companies take anywhere from 2.5% to 4.5% off the top of millions and millions of transactions every single week, and they provide zero value whatsoever. So, in essence, you're losing 2.5% of your money every single time you make a transaction. The merchants lose it. The buyers lose it. It's a disaster. And so a need has arisen for a new currency, a global currency, one that anyone can buy and then anyone can trade with. The scale of the recent boom and bust has been staggering indeed, but it's actually been healthy. It's actually been working. At the start of the year, a Bitcoin was worth $13.51. Earlier this week, it traded as high as $266. You obviously see the problem, right? Somebody could invest a lot of money in Bitcoins at $13.51. Wait till it gets to $266 and then give away their Bitcoins and let them flood the market with worthless Bitcoins, thus plummeting the price. And that's exactly what happened. Somebody, some single individual or a single bank purchased $12 billion worth of Bitcoins, $12 billion with a B, and then gave it away on Reddit, just gave it all away. And sure enough, all those people that got those Bitcoins ran right out and spent it. And when they spent it, the price plummeted from $266, and on Thursday, it dropped to $100.30. Now, it bounced back to about $160, but it has settled down to about $100. That would destroy any other currency to see those kinds of swings. Now, what has happened, of course, is that the exchanges, like I won't mention the exchanges and go look it up for yourself, but the exchanges stopped trading or they slowed down trading in order to stop the panic. Such monumental appreciation and volatility is clearly the result of speculation. Obviously, someone in the big banks wanted to destroy Bitcoins overnight, and they spent $12 billion to try and do it, and they failed. But Bitcoin's gains are not the result of speculation alone. They partly reflect the fact that the Bitcoin system is much better designed than previous online currencies. And here's why. More significantly, the run-up also reflects anxiety about the safety of global banking system and the stability of major international currencies. A lot of things at play here, a very complicated algorithm. But the technicalities of the Bitcoin system are complex, which makes them beautiful. To make this online currency more successful than previous versions, the designers overcame two key challenges, and this is what makes it unique. This is what gives it hope. We may yet have a universal one-world currency, not driven by any bank, not driven by any government, completely anonymous, completely decentralized, and nobody controls the value, and here's why. To prevent counterfeiting, which we also call naked shorting, like the Federal Reserve does it every single day. Yeah, Well, they attach a history of transactions to each currency unit, but allowed users to keep their transactions nearly anonymous. Yes, you can buy prostitution and drugs and all kinds of things with bitcoins, to which many people are saying, so what? Counterfeiting is hard because fake bitcoins would need an authenticated history to pass muster, and it's impossible to counterfeit. They strictly control the supply of bitcoins, outstanding, thereby saving it from the disastrous fate of, for example, paper currency known as assignats, which were issued during the later stages of the French Revolution. Initially, assignats were backed by land and buildings that had been seized from the church. If the French government had issued only enough assignats for that property, there would have been plenty of assignats to spend until the property was disposed of. But the government liked having extra money, and it didn't cancel the assignats as the property was sold. In fact, they kept printing more and more and more and more. And within 5 years, there was very, very serious inflation. That's exactly what happens now. So there are a lot of ideas which would have stopped the $12 billion Bitcoin investor, which many suspect is a major bank, from trying to kill the Bitcoin. They could limit the amount of the daily transaction. They could limit the amount a single account can gain. There's a lot of things that can be done. Interestingly enough, the Bitcoins have no backing at all. Nothing. They're not backed by gold. They're not backed by land, citrus fruits, pork bellies, nothing. What they do have, however, and what has turned out to be even more important, is a mathematical formula limiting the growth of the supply outstanding. Over time, the formula for the Bitcoin supply actually reduces the amount of new currency added to the system. And the new Bitcoins are not created by fiat, like dollars are now, but in exchange for valuable labor. They are paid to computer hobbyists who monitor the Bitcoin system to keep it running and prevent counterfeiting. It is all run by a system of prime numbers. It's extremely complex. It has something like 20 trillion combinations, which are impossible to counterfeit. Critics have argued that a currency like Bitcoins would be inherently deflationary because the supply can't be adjusted in response to economic conditions. The same argument could be made about a gold standard, of course, because they don't make much more gold. Yeah, we mine it, but we put it in bars and we put it in the bank, and it's got a pretty limited supply. Moreover, the relatively small supply of such hard currency means that the inflow and outflow of hot money can make them highly volatile. The price of gold, for example, climbed from, less than $300 an ounce 11 years ago to almost $1,900 last year before dropping to $1,564 today. Those are pretty wild swings, and it's because gold doesn't exist in large quantities. You can't just make more gold. That's the whole argument against fiat currency, is that you have a limited supply that is linked to some kind of value. Well, there's a strong argument that the appreciation and volatility of all these currencies reflects reasonable concerns about the global economy and the banking system. Hello, of course we have reasonable concerns. Remember when we broke the story about the Cyprus bank heist, when the IMF moved in and literally seized depositors' money in order to bail out the bank? That really erodes the trust of the depositors, people. Now, of course, the very large depositors were able to sneak into the bank a few days before and get their money out. But the average person, the middle-class person, they were taken to the cleaners by that bank. Now, fortunately, they only took accounts with deposits of over $100,000, which most people, and I gather probably around half of the listeners of X Squared Radio, are not in that category. So, you know what we say? Go ahead. Take the rich's money. We don't care. I only have $92,000 in the bank. Well, you know what appeasement is, don't you? Mm-hmm. That's when you let the alligator eat your friends, hoping it will eat you last. Could these online currencies ever reach a level at which they altered or obstructed government policy? The answer is maybe. President Clinton's advisor, James Carville, famously joked that if he were reincarnated, he would want to come back as the bond market, because you can intimidate everyone. Just as the so-called bond vigilantes acted as a brake on Washington's fiscal policy in the 1990s, one day currency vigilantes could act as a similar brake on monetary policy. Well, it ain't working now, because Mr. Bernanke is going through 55-gallon drums of ink every hour. The internet will almost certainly offer access to a growing number of currencies in one form or another that are beyond national control. In other words, all those money makers, all those money changers, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, Chase, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Fidelity, Mass Mutual, all those people that are manipulating the market every single day with buying and selling and forcing and the naked shorting, all that control goes away. All that quantitative easing becomes obsolete. Government will fight back of that, there can be no doubt. But virtual currencies will be no easier to control than Facebook, because it's not centrally located. Stopping the movement of capital will be possible only if countries are willing to impose harsh taxes and capital controls, and they're not willing to do that. Once alternative currencies are frictionless, available on the internet, every laptop will become its own Cayman Island. However, the current boom and bust plays out, Bitcoin is the beginning of something and not the end. I can guarantee you that. I want you to listen to this story. I think you're going to enjoy it. Then we'll take a quick break.
Bitcoin's anything goes nature has made it a target for hackers who have quickly learned to steal the virtual money. But William Mook, an entrepreneur who tracks Bitcoin markets, says the actual damage is being exaggerated.
There was a loss of $12,500 just after Christmas from one individual. But in the United States, according to the FBI, there are three bank robberies a day, and they lose $7,500 each time, three times a day, 365 days a year. But people still use those banks.
But at least people with money in those banks do have a guarantee from that bank. Who guarantees my bitcoins?
The numerical process guarantees your bitcoins, and it can't be altered by politics, as the people in Cyprus found out. The bitcoin is a prime number, a series of prime numbers. Basically, just like you can break eggs, and it's hard to put them back together, there are certain things you can do with numbers that are easy to do but hard to undo unless you know the secret. And those secrets involve special numbers. And so I can lock something away, send it to you, and nobody else can unlock it except you. And that's the basis of secret messages. It's also the basis of things that you cannot counterfeit. Just like you find gold in a sea of rock and dirt, you find these special numbers in a sea of very, very big numbers. There's only 2.1 quadrillion of those numbers that are special. About 1.1 quadrillion of these numbers, or 11 million bitcoins, have already been found. Another 10 million will be found over the rest of history, and most of them will be found within the next 3 years.
Well, Bitcoin zoomed to a record price of $266 per unit this week until a flash crash saw it lose half its value, but it clawed its way back up within a few hours. The valuation roller coaster is earning the digital currency more and more attention in the financial headlines. Sarah Firth met a Bitcoin developer in London to find out whether it's still a good investment.
Well, now you've heard what Bitcoin is, why is it proving so popular? Industry insiders are dismissing this as a bubble, But right now, they're having to dismiss Bitcoin as even more of a bubble. And that's because this week, for the first time, the controversial electronic currency passed the $200 mark, setting new records. So it is proving popular.
I don't think it will be widely used for a while yet, because until the interface becomes user-friendly, it's a bit like people think they have to understand it to be able to use it. But I say to people, look, do you understand how your body works and how money works? You can use your body and use money. With Bitcoin, you don't have to understand how to use it, but you do need an interface. And in order to understand money, we have a nice interface to use money. To use your body, we have a nice interface called our body. In terms of Bitcoin, we haven't yet got that interface up to that level of ease of use and understanding. And until that day comes, it won't be so widely available or easily used by people.
So Bitcoin's well and truly burst onto the mainstream now, trading up around the $200 mark, up from under just $20 at the beginning of the year. But is Bitcoin still a good investment now it is trading around that $200 mark? Well, many people think yes, it is. And here's why. Let's take a look at the possible outcomes if you invested in Bitcoin right now. The bubble could burst. It could go from trading around $200 to zero, in which case you lose 100% of your money. Not good, but you do only lose 100% when it comes to Bitcoin. But what if Bitcoin rose to around $2,000 to start trading around that? Inconceivable, maybe. All the skeptics, all the critics right now will tell you that the bubble will burst. That won't happen. But ask yourself this. At the beginning of the year, when Bitcoin was trading around that $20 mark, did you really think that it could start trading around the $200 mark? So, on that basis that things can and do happen, if Bitcoin rose to start trading around $2,000 and you'd invested now when it was around $200, you would get 10 times your return. So if you lose, you lose 100%, but you win and you win 1,000%. Now, to anyone, you can clearly see that that's quite a good bet. And it's why right now, along with all the global uncertainty with the big financial institutions, many people consider that you could do worse than bet on Bitcoin.
Now, that's maybe a flawed logic, but the beauty behind the entire Bitcoin system, and it's why I wanted it as a story, is because it is based on these mathematical algorithms that are very complex, and they're limited. You can't just keep creating them and creating them. And once they have all been discovered, which he said should happen in the next 2 to 3 years, you have a fixed number. And that means that no one can go out there and counterfeit it. There's no naked shorting of Bitcoins. And we're not just talking about speculating, going back and forth between dollars and euros and yen and yuan and whatever. We're talking about making purchases with these Bitcoins. There are car dealerships. There are all kinds of online sales locations which are beginning to accept Bitcoins. I can tell you right now that as soon as it is possible, all the businesses that I operate will begin accepting Bitcoins. I strongly support this. Any kind of decentralized, uncontrollable, almost anonymous money is a great idea. It gets us closer to the ideal of something that is out of the control of the money changers. Let's take a quick break. It's just a little bit past the top of the hour. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio right after this. and welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agner. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast tonight is about 73 degrees. Really, really spectacular weather the last couple of days. One day in the 80s, and today it was in the high 70s. Really, really beautiful. Nice, nice weather. We're having a great spring here east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our phone lines anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. And don't forget, if you need to step out, you can still listen by cell phone. By dialing 805-399-1000 and then the passcode 769-608. Put it on speed dial, or you can go to x2-radio.com. And if you look on the left-hand side of the page, right there at the top, you'll see our new Android app. You can click on that, and then you're just one touch away from BBS Radio Channel 2. We have been on the BBS Radio Network for about 8 years now. And we're happy. We have been here a long time. And if you think you have what it takes to be a talk radio host here on BBS Radio Network, please write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll give you some pointers. We'll talk about your content and your ideas, and I can get you sponsored, and we'll see if you have what it takes to be on the radio every day or once a week. And you can get your voice out there. It's not that hard to do, unless you run out of things to say, which does happen from time to time, even with the pros. In this hour, if you'll remember, we had Neil Kramer on the program. He is a British national in this country, and having grown up in London, he saw what it is like when a city that size becomes disarmed by the government. They have very, very strict firearms controls there. And as a result, London is arguably the most violent city in the world. We also have a couple of cities like that here in this country. Chicago has one of the strictest gun control laws in the country, and is arguably the most violent city in this nation. And that's just because only outlaws have the guns. Now, the reason I bring this up is not to tell you go run out and buy a gun, because there's a whole philosophy that goes behind that. Yeah, we kind of get a panic about it. We said, oh, gee, I better go get my gun now. Then we're not going to be able to get them. They're going to round us all up. You know, give some heavy thought to that, because if you ever pick that gun up to shoot anything but a paper target, even if you don't pull the trigger, your life is going to be different forever. Everything will change. So just think about that. It's not so much of a jump between stopping off at Walmart and picking up that 22 caliber rifle, or by the pawn shop and picking up that 38 revolver, throwing some slugs in it and thinking that you can pick it up and point it at somebody and tell them to go away. It's not that far of a distance, people. And I can tell you from personal experience, when you have that day, whether you pull the trigger or not, your dreams will change. Now, the UN has passed sweeping international arms regulation, and it's viewed by many, this talk radio host included, as a Second Amendment override. The United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday signed off on a sweeping, first-of-its-kind treaty to regulate the international arms trade. Now, this brushes aside worries from U.S. gun rights advocates that the pact could lead to a national firearms registry and disrupt the American gun market. Right now, we don't have such a thing. It's done by state by state. Some states you have to register your firearm, and some states you don't. Some states have a very involved background check, and some states don't. This is a state-by-state commerce issue. The federal government does have firearms regulations, but they are limited only to the actual use of the firearm in committing a crime, not in the possession of the firearm, although many bills are trying to work their way down the zigzag aisle in Washington. The long-debated UN Arms Trade Treaty, it's also called the ATT, requires countries to regulate and control the export of weaponry such as battle tanks, combat vehicles, aircraft, helicopters, as well as parts and ammunition for those weapons. It also provides that signatories will not violate arms embargoes, international treaties regarding illicit trafficking, or sell weaponry to countries for genocide, crimes against humanity, or other war crimes. We had the ECOWAS. ECOWAS is the Economic Council of West African States that was formed to literally take control of all the gold and diamond mines in West Africa. The reason for doing that was to eliminate what's called blood diamonds. Now, you've seen the movies about it, but the reality is that diamonds and gold, unregulated, raw, are traded for weapons for warlords. And so what happened was ECOWAS moved in, standardized it, guarded it, and took a lot of that stray commodity currency out of the system. Now those things are much more tightly regulated, much more tightly controlled. They have to be changed into cash, and then the cash can be tracked, and you don't have rocks and metal being traded for gold or being traded for weapons and ammunition. Now, American gun rights activists insist the treaty is riddled with loopholes and is unworkable, in part because it includes a, quote, small arms and light weapons, close quote, in its list of weaponry subject to international regulations. American gun rights activists, such as the NRA, do not trust UN assertions that the pact is meant to regulate only cross-border trade and would have no impact on domestic U.S. laws and markets. It's a slippery slope. It's an easy jump. It's very simple, especially when you have an administration who so easily defers decisions of this manner to the UN, which is much to the consternation of constitutionalists in the Senate and the Congress. Critics of the treaty were heartened by U.S. Senate's resistance to ratifying the document, assuming President Obama sent it to the chamber for ratification. He could just do it by executive order. In its budget debate late last month, the Senate approved a non-binding amendment opposing the treaty offered by Senator James Inhofe, Oklahoma Republican, with 8 Democrats joining, all 45 Republicans backing the amendment. Senator Jerry Moran, he's the Kansas Republican, said Tuesday that passing a treaty Iran, Syria, and North Korea will just ignore will only serve to constrain law-abiding countries like the U.S. The U.S. Senate is united in strong opposition to a treaty that puts us on a level ground with dictatorships who abuse human rights and arm terrorists. But there is real concern that the administration feels pressured to sign a treaty that violates our constitutional rights, Mr. Moran said. Given the apparent support of the Obama administration for the ATT, this UN treaty, members of the U.S. Senate must continue to make clear that any treaty that violates our Second Amendment freedoms will be an absolute non-starter for ratification. Mr. Inhofe likewise said Mr. Obama should take the Senate vote seriously. It's time the Obama administration recognizes the treaty is already a non-starter and Americans will not stand for internationalists limiting and infringing upon their constitutional rights, the Oklahoma Republican said. Furthermore, this treaty could also disrupt diplomatic and national security efforts by preventing our government from assisting allies like Taiwan, South Korea, or Israel when they require assistance, which we often do. We send weapons to South Korea, we send weapons and ammunition to Israel, and we have sent missiles and weapons to Taiwan. That's what precipitated China selling off all our short-term T-bills over there. It hurt them, but it hurt us worse. White House spokesman Jay Carney said Tuesday that we are pleased to join with the consensus on the treaty, adding that before the White House gets to planning on how to get it through the Senate, we'll first review and assess the language of the treaty itself. So do not be surprised if you see an executive order aligning the federal policy on transportation of small arms and weapons with the UN policy. Despite the Senate vote, numerous groups have pressured Mr. Obama to support the treaty. I wonder who those groups might be. Probably ones with lots of money. The voices of reason triumphed over skeptics, treaty opponents, and dealers in death to establish a revolutionary treaty that constitutes a major step toward keeping assault rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, and other weapons out of the hands of despots and warlords who use them to kill and maim civilians, recruit child soldiers, and commit other serious abuses, said Frank Januzzi, Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. And those are the examples that they use to try to push this kind of treaty through. In reality, that's a very, very small amount of the weapons that are being moved, and those kinds of movements are already illegal. They don't need a treaty to regulate those. What they need is to grow a pair and go after the groups that are trafficking in those weapons. And by the way, a lot of those weapons are made right here. The American Bar Association also released a white paper arguing that the treaty would not affect Second Amendment rights. Nonsense. Absolutely would affect it. General Assembly President Vuk Jeremic said Tuesday that the lack of a regulatory framework on the import and transfer of conventional arms has made a daunting contribution to ongoing conflict, regional instabilities, displacement of people's terrorism, and transnational organized crime. And let's not keep out of the equation that most of the arms merchants, and I'm not talking about the people that actually manufacture the weapons, I'm talking about the merchants of those weapons, are in the U.S. and Israel. So a lot of those weapons are being transported, sold, and distributed into networks that oppose enemies of our states, respectively. In other words, we arm rebels in Syria, and then we stand back and watch the news about how people standing in Nike jumpsuits and wearing New Balance tennis shoes are shooting rocket-propelled grenades made in the United States at helicopters made in Russia. The arms trade business is alive and well, and this treaty is going to do absolutely nothing to stop that kind of trade. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice. Okay, we have often talked about the currency wars. It's an interesting comparison because, as you know, here at X Squared Radio, this is where the past meets the future. In 1931, we had a currency war that began when several European nations withdrew from the gold standard and were able to, you know, manipulate and float their currencies where they wanted to. Now, we have had pretty much stability, I guess, for about the last 80 years as far as currency wars, although we've had guys like George Soros who have used their billions, his billions, and his lack of mercy on the monetary markets. And he actually broke the Bank of England single-handedly. You could say that was a currency war because he really slaughtered their currency. Well, they survived, but they had to, you know, bail themselves out of it. Soros has no mercy. And in January of this year, began a very rapid effort to make $1 billion off the Japanese yen. Well, now, because the Japanese have now changed governors, and the new governor has a different strategy than the old governor, he has decided to follow Bernanke's lead. So the Bank of Japan has now unleashed the world's most intense burst of monetary stimulus in history, promising to inject about $1.4 trillion into the economy in less than 2 years. A radical gamble that sent the yen reeling and bond markets to record lows. New governor Haruhiku Kuroda committed to the BOJ to open-ended asset buying and said the monetary base would nearly double to 270 trillion yen by the end of 2014 in a shock therapy to end two decades of stagnation. Now, I want to comment on the stagnation because, as you know, the United States entered a period of stagnation, but it did so in terrible shape. We had automotive industry that was bankrupt. We bailed it out. Then we lied to the American people and said that the auto industry had paid it back. They have not. The General Motors is 64% of their preferred stock is still owned by the federal government. Hence, we call GM Government Motors. They hate it, by the way. They don't like it at all. They would love to be able to buy themselves out of it, but it appears that the White House rather enjoys owning 64% of the preferred stock of General Motors. We also saw Chrysler broken and almost 800 of its dealerships very selectively closed, only on a basis of whether they were contributors to the Republican Party or not. If they were contributors to the Republican Party, they were summarily shut down. We saw all of this. And then, by the way, the man that was responsible for that went to prison afterwards for fraud. He was Mr. Obama's car czar. We entered that period of stagnation in the worst possible shape. Japan, on the other hand, entered their 20 years of stagnation in the best possible shape. Their auto industries were profitable. Toyota, Honda, Mitsubishi, Nissan, all of them profitable, all of them world class. Their debt to GDP was only 25% at the time. They were the model economy. And look what it has done to them. The U.S. Federal Reserve may buy more debt under its quantitative easing, but with the Japanese economy about one-third of the size of the United States, the scope of Kuroda's quantitative and qualitative monetary easing is absolutely unmatched. This is an unprecedented degree of monetary easing, a smiling Kuroda told a news conference after his first policy meeting at the helm of the central bank. By the way, this policy did not sit well with the outgoing governor. The two might as well have squared off in martial arts and duked it out on the Capitol steps. That's how different their policies were and how vehemently they expressed their opinions one to another. We took all available steps we can think of. I'm confident that all necessary measures to achieve 2% inflation in 2 years were taken today, he said. One of those steps was to abandon interest rates as a target and become the only major central bank to primarily target the monetary base, the amount of cash it pumps out to the economy. It adopted a similar policy in 2001 through 2006, but not on this scale, nowhere close. The scope of the changes Kuroda pushed through and the fact he secured unanimous board support for them, of course, they were probably all getting multi-billion dollar bonuses, drove the yen down sharply, knocked the 10-year bond yield to a record low, and nudged Tokyo share prices just shy of a 4.5-year closing high. I wonder why. The result is nothing short of regime change, HSBC's Japan economist Izumi Diyalye said in a report. By the way, HSBC was busted late last year for laundering billions and billions of dollars worth of illegal drug money. In fact, they were laundering so much cash that HSBC created a special box that the drug lords would use to stack their cash in. You know how they bundle money together in these money bands, coin rollers, stuff like that. These boxes would hold a fixed amount of $100 bills, and the boxes were specially crafted so that they would fit through the teller windows at the banks. That's how much money they were taking in. Oh, they got busted. They got busted for taking in the cash for selling the heroin into your neighborhoods, your kids, your families, your town is flooded with heroin paid for by HSBC's laundered money. What did they do? Well, they didn't prosecute them. All they did is fine them. So as part of the cost of doing business, HSBC paid $1.2 billion in a sort of handling fee, a second level of laundering, so that now that money actually goes into the agency that wanted to control it. So there you go, double laundered money. And make no mistake that the Taliban are the largest, most violent drug lords ever to live on the face of the earth, bigger even than the opium drug lords of Great Britain during the Opium Wars. The BOJ has now made a much firmer commitment to achieving its 2% inflation goal and has demonstrated that it will do anything short of foreign bond buying to achieve this goal. The scope of Kuroda's overhaul offered immediate comfort to Japanese markets but contains major risks. It could leave the central bank heavily exposed to government debt and potentially huge losses if it failed to stoke inflation and investors lost faith in its efforts to revive the economy. And it could trigger a currency war. And I use a capital C on that. In fact, I would say it will trigger a currency war as other Asian exporters seek to remain competitive with a weaker yen. It is as if we've gone back to the quantitative easing of the 2000s, said Hirokai Muto, senior economist at Sumitomo Mitsui Asset Management in Tokyo. The targeting the monetary base will lead to a huge increase in current account balances that commercial banks keep at the BOJ, but I'm still not sure if this money will move through the economy. The Bank of Japan, that's the BOJ, will probably do a better job than the Fed does. When the Fed prints money, $85 billion a month now, it goes straight into the high-level credit markets and never makes it down to you and me. No. You cannot go to the bank, your local Wells Fargo bank, your local Bank of America or wherever, and borrow some of that money. It never reaches that level. These are very, very high-level credit markets. And what this money is being used for is to trade currencies back and forth, micro trades back and forth, back and forth. It never is actually there to shore up the credit markets. It's just there to buy these derivatives, to keep them from collapsing. It's a temporary fix, this quantitative easing. And the fact that it's being pumped in every single month like clockwork makes the brokers and the market makers in Wall Street absolutely giddy. They must be buying up Ferraris and Lamborghinis and Maseratis every single week. They got to do something with these huge commissions that they're making. But the Bank of Japan is probably going to do a better job at getting that money to the consumer level, getting it into the hands of businesses that can use that money to buy inventory, to create jobs, and to make their base move forward. The monetary base, or cash and reserves at the Bank of Japan, already hit a record in March, but the huge pile of money has failed to end deflation or boost wages. If it makes it to the local credit markets where businesses can borrow that, then it will, because they will add jobs. Those people will go to work. Those people will spend their money. The money that they spend will also partially go to local taxes, which will go to boost municipalities, thus alleviating their demand on the country's money and be able to reverse the flow of cash back to the central government. Kuroda's first policy meeting since taking office on March 20th was seen as a big test of his ability to steer the Bank of Japan towards the unorthodox measures to meet the inflation target. And I would say he pulled it off. The outgoing governor had a lot of people loyal to him, and they didn't necessarily like Kuroda's strategy, but I'm sure when they started looking at what it was going to mean in terms of their bonuses, it didn't take long to win them over. Government bond futures soared, and the benchmark 10-year bond yield hit 0.425%, its lowest ever. The yen, which had been creeping up in the run-up to the meeting, plunged, driving the dollar up by more than 2% to around 95.25 yen. Wow, that's high. We used to see it around 10 yen. The Nikkei stock index unwound losses of more than 2% to end up 2.2%, just shy of a 4.5-year high last month. And that is a good sign, but it is only a sign of the inflation of the money supply. The same exact thing that's going on in our stock market. Oh, we're just ringing the bell off the bracket at Wall Street in an adrenaline high each time that Dow average goes higher and higher. But remember, there's no value in those stocks. Those companies are not profitable. They're not cash flowing. The economy has not turned around. This is all fake. It's just the value of the Dow. It's just a number. It's magic money that's being created by the Fed. It isn't real. Now, if you're investing in the stock market and you're taking advantage of this 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% rise in the stock value, you are gambling with something that has no value. You're going to get in low, get out high, and you're going to pat yourself on the back. But you're going to get caught. You're going to get caught. The entire Dow is going to get caught. And when it adjusts, just play this episode of X Squared Radio, and you'll know exactly what happened. Okay, enough of that. It is now official policy. The U.S. will not, I repeat, not be returning to the moon. That's true. I know a lot of you were saying, wait a minute, didn't Bush say 2020 we were going back to the moon? Yeah, but that was Bush. By the way, all of those 10-year plans, anything that you see that any president says, we're going to start reducing this, we're going to start increasing that, we're going to start doing that, and I promise this will begin taking place in 2 years after my second term is over. You might as well just flush it right down the toilet, because it ain't going to happen. The next president that comes in is going to say, that's nonsense, we're not doing that, I got better uses for the money. I want a $40 million mansion in Hawaii, and I want it outfitted with the best. And I want security for life, for me, my wife, and my kids. That's what we're going to use that money for. So forget about it. We're not going to the moon. America won't be repeating that historic one small step. NASA is not going to the moon with a human as a primary project, probably in my lifetime, Charlie Bolden, who's the NASA chief, said in a joint meeting of the Space Studies Board and the Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board in Washington last week. I am sure he was not happy about it. Instead, he said, the focus would remain on human missions to asteroids and to Mars. We intend to do that, and we think it can be done. Meanwhile, interest in the moon has been growing in both private sector and foreign countries for a lot of reasons. Last week, Russia rekindled its plan for a robotic moon exploration program, unveiling its first new moon mission since the Soviet Union launched Luna 24 way back in 1976. Russian space scientists are scripting a new plan to reconnect with the moon, one scientist explained. Exploration of the moon is an important part of the program, said Igor Mitrofanov of the Institute for Space Research during Microsymposium 54 on Lunar Far Side and Poles, new destinations for exploration held in the Woodlands, Texas, on March 16th and 17th. Ooh, I would love to have been a fly on the wall at the dinner after the symposium. I just want to emphasize that Russia is a space-faring country, not only with the robotic but also manned flight, he added. And private interest in the moon is a resource that's heating up. Why? Why indeed? Several companies have announced plans to mine the moon, thought to contain a ransom in precious minerals, including titanium, platinum, and the absolutely priceless helium-3, a rare isotope of helium that many feel could be the future of energy on Earth and in space. Moon Express, one of the companies targeting the moon and competing in Google's Lunar XPrize to reach our satellite, recently said it plans a mission to begin exploring the moon in 2015. In his remarks last Thursday, NASA's Bolden acknowledged the widespread interest in the moon from other nations and said his agency would be willing to help. They all have dreams of putting humans on the moon, he said. I have told every head of agency of every partner agency that if you assume the lead in a human lunar mission, NASA will be a part of that. NASA wants to be a participant. Now, I have to tell you, in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, and if you have any thoughts on this, I would really appreciate you sharing them with me at 888-429-5471. I think there are more reasons than that why we're not going back to the moon. I have often said for 8 years on this program, in fact, I think way back in September of 2005, when we first started X Squared Radio, I had a special guest on whose name was Dean Ford, and we took one side and the other of a debate on whether or not we actually landed on the moon at all. Of course, we won the argument that we had, in fact, landed on the moon. There was lots and lots of evidence that we had done so. And in all the missions that we ran, we still had launch engines, and I'm talking about fully prepared crews, launch engines, recovery systems, geological surveys, and everything planned out for two whole missions after the last Apollo mission to the moon. We just up and quit. And it wasn't so much that the U.S. had lost interest in it, because everyone knew then, and we still know now, that the country, the power that controls the moon, controls the earth. He who controls the moon controls the earth. Now, why would you think that the United States, Russia, China, and the European Space Agency would simultaneously decide that we're not going back to the moon? And now, all of a sudden, with some private mining companies, and believe me, it's not going to be that hard to raise the investment money to get an engine up there. We've got the launch vehicles. We've got the ability. It's got gravity. It's got oxygen. It's got water. There's shelter. Everything you need is on the moon. Why do you think Russia is making this move? Why do you think NASA is, in the first part of this article, saying there's no way we're sending humans back to the moon, period, not in my lifetime? And Bolden's not an old person. He's younger than I am. Why in the world would we make that statement? And then at the very end say, oh, by the way, anybody that wants to take the lead going up there, we'll be a partner. We're ready to help. We want to be a participant. Why do you think that is? What's your suspicion? What do you think is going on? When a mere 3 days away, and that's by slow boat, by the way, because we have an excellent story on the fusion-driven rocket. Oh, yeah, you're going to love this story. This is what's going on. This is where we have reduced the transit time from Earth to Mars to 30 days. 30 days, my friends. That's right. The fusion-driven rocket, which is kind of old technology, it's just that the way that they're approaching it is a little bit better. Fusion, well, before I get into the story, I want to tell you the importance, because if we can go to the moon, we now have a low-gravity launch platform. We have the ability to launch stuff, not 150 tons, we have the ability to launch stuff 1 million tons. We can ship it up there in pieces, just like we did the space station, except instead of doing spacewalks on an umbilical cord out there where little meteorites can pierce your suit at any given moment, you're exposed to solar flares and all kinds of space radiation. You can do all this in shelter. You can do all this on the leeward side of the moon. You can do this in huge chambers big enough to hold hangars way, way bigger than anything we have on this planet. Yes, it would take a couple of decades to get the working materials and tools up there. But once you've got that up there, once you've got a closed-in work area of a few million cubic yards, you have all the oxygen that you need up there. You got all the water that you need up there. You have all the energy that you need up there. Within 50 to 100 years, at the very most, you could have a full thriving society on the moon. Well, that society on the moon is pretty much impervious to anything that Earth can throw at it, but not so the other way. Yeah, exactly right. Because any society on the moon is going to have to be subterranean. You're not going to build domes on the surface of the moon. Come on, use your head. You're going to build it underneath the surface of the moon, several thousand feet into volcanic tubes. You've got everything you need. You got heat, you got oxygen, you have water, everything you need is right there on the moon, and you're protected. There isn't anything this world could throw at the moon to damage a society or a business that would be operating up there. Besides, if you're mining up there, if you control helium-3, you control the supply of helium-3, that's like 5,000 times better than controlling all the lithium on this planet. Right now, China controls the lithium reserves and the processing ability, so they're the only ones that make batteries. So they control the electric vehicle, the solar, and the wind generation industries, because, and you know, they have cornered the market on the rare earth metals. But if you corner the market on helium-3, that's like cornering the market on the cleanest, most abundant form of energy you could possibly think of. And he who controls that will control the world. So the fusion-driven rocket. As I said, it's kind of old technology, but it has been difficult to control in days past. The way you do this is with a fuel called tritium. Now, you know, what we do at CERN is we take hydrogen and we accelerate big, huge protons that we energize with all kinds of energy till they're, you know, several teravolts, and we slam them into each other and bust them all to pieces. But in reality, what we do for fusion is we want to drive the hydrogen protons together to fuse to make helium. When they do, they release a tremendous amount of energy, enough to fuse more hydrogen molecules together to make more helium. We typically call that a bomb. That's how we enrich gamma explosions, by injecting tritium a few nanoseconds after the actual explosion, so that we're adding more and more energetic neutrons to the reaction. It's sort of like dumping a 5-gallon bucket of ping pong balls into a room loaded with mousetraps with other ping pong balls on them. The more ping pong balls you load in there or throw in there, the faster the reaction takes place. Well, that's the same thing with tritium. Now, deuterium is a hydrogen with a neutron associated with it. Normally, hydrogen just has one electron sailing around it, no one has shell. But tritium is hydrogen with two neutrons, so it has plenty of big particles. The neutrons are the same size as the proton, but they are a different or neutral charge. It's basically a proton that a electron has fallen into. When you fuse these together, they form helium and can generate a lot of energy. Now, typically what we do is we take the deuterium and tritium and we compress it into a pellet. So let's just think of it like a steel ball bearing made of hydrogen, and it's compressed into the shape of, let's say, a golf ball. And then you can take that golf ball and you squeeze it to the size of a BB. Now, yeah, that takes a tremendous amount of energy, and normally we use gamma radiation to do that because it has a very uniform way of compressing. So you make a shape charge out of, let's say, C4. You put uranium in it or plutonium in it, in the center of it, and you implode the ball. So you're smashing the plutonium in on itself until it becomes supercritical. And then you flood it with tritium, and there's your bomb. Well, that's not exactly what we want when you're talking about generating energy. We don't want to explode a hydrogen bomb every single time we want to move something. That would be a real mess. What you want to do is you want to flow the tritium to it in a controlled method, like a sort of throttle. Or you want to control the compression. Instead of using an atom bomb to compress it, you use something that will smash it to criticality in a very pulsed, very controlled way. And so what the fusion-driven rocket has done is they use either aluminum or they use lithium metal bands. And they put the pellets into this structure very, very closely, very, very tight into the bands. And then all you have to do is apply a charge to the bands and get the bands to compress. And believe me, they can compress to several gigapascals of pressure. And when they do this compression, it forms the criticality in a very controlled manner. And so you get somewhere around, let's see if I can get to the numbers here. I'm just going by memory. Ah, here we go. What they do is they can generate several megawatts of energy, and they can accelerate a craft weighing about 150 tons That's a very big craft, by the way. And a lot of that weight is payload. It's not fuel, because this has so much thrust, about 200,000 pounds of thrust. You can push... I'm sorry, let's see. Oh, yeah, 150-ton system. It uses magnetism to compress lithium or aluminum metal bands, there we go, around the deuterium-tritium fuel pellet to initiate fusion. The resulting microsecond reaction forces the propellant mass out at 30 kilometers per second. That's way faster than the 5,500 meters per second that we have normally seen, about six times more powerful, and will be able to pulse every minute or so and not cause a G-force damage to the spacecraft's occupants or to the machines in the spacecraft. The spent fuel pellet is ejected behind the motor to provide propulsion, and because the whole process is magnetically controlled, there's relatively little wear and tear on the engines. In other words, there's no moving parts. A pellet the size of a grain of sand would provide the same propellant as a gallon of conventional rocket fuel, which is normally hydrogen peroxide. Also, this requires electrical power to control and contain the reaction. And that electrical power is normally generated or accumulated by the solar panels. The magnetic inertial confinement fusion over that requiring massive lasers, which is what we have used in the past. We've used Omni lasers, 21 megawatt lasers, very carefully positioned around the pellet to do the compression. And it's a little difficult to do. It's sort of like smashing a water balloon in your hands. You would think that the balloon would be, you know, compressible. But when you press in on it with your fingers, inevitably somewhere between your finger and your thumb or your wrist and your palm, the balloon squirts out. And that's exactly why fusion is very difficult to do with the massive lasers, because you get these blowouts in the sides, and you don't get the uniform compression that you do with a gamma explosion. Lots and lots of efforts have been made to use these Omega or Omni lasers to do this compression, and it's only been successfully done by I think it's ITER. ITER would be the a combination of Japanese and European groups to practice using fusion for power generation here on Earth. It's not very practical. It hasn't been done in a hot fashion where you can get more energy out than we put in. And so it really is not practical. But in the method of this motor, it can be used because you're not trying to contain the radiation. By the way, tritium has a very, very short half-life of about 125 days. So not to worry about, you know, radioactive fuel making its way or radioactive exhaust making its way back to Earth. That's not going to happen. It only has a half-life of about 125 days. Very, very small particles. And once they effuse out into space, they're going to be relatively harmless. The solution is dilution. So they say this is very scalable, and it can achieve fusion at much smaller scale. They could run the designed engine off of 200 kilowatt solar panels, which is about the same power as generated by the panels around the International Space Station. Using the fusion-driven system, flight time to the red planet of Mars would take between 30 and 90 days compared to 8 months that it took to send Curiosity to Mars. The 30-day trip would require 3 days of engine operation to get the spacecraft up to speed, and then you would coast, and then 3 days to slow it down into orbit around Mars. So easy peasy, 6 days running that thing, store up the energy, use the capacitors to discharge into the bands. Simple, Simon. It could very easily be done. It's not something we want to try here on Earth. And the reason is, as I said, once the tritium particles are fused and they come out, some of the exhaust will be radioactive. And these are extremely small particles. We're talking about proton-sized particles. not too many containments can hold it. You can absorb it in lead and hope, you know, that it will decay in time. But if you have any kind of mistake, any kind of explosion, any kind of break in the containment, you've got a radioactive problem for about 3 or 4 months. It's still not practical to use to boil water and turn steam turbines the way we do fission reactions now. But it's getting there. It's getting there. Such a motor would also be considerably cheaper to launch than a chemical rocket system. Well, since you don't have to lift the fuel out of gravity before it starts a trip, the proposed design for the 150-ton spacecraft would allow around a third of that mass to be used for cargo, human or otherwise, and the reduced flight time would reduce the exposure of astronauts to the effect of solar radiation. You don't want to put astronauts up there 8 months in space out beyond the Van Allen radiation belts because you're exposed to anything the sun might blast at you. And in order to make a chamber stiff enough to withstand the radiation that the sun would put off in a burst like that, and the odds of it doing it in an eighth-month period right here in the solar maximum are very good, it would be nearly impossible to lift it, and you'd have to give up payload, which could be used for so many other neat things. So reduce the time period to about 30, 35 days, and the odds of exposing the astronauts to any long-term damage by the radiation, very, very slim. Many space stations use aerobraking, using the friction of a planet's atmosphere to slow down as a way of saving the propellant. This drive, however, is so efficient that aerobraking makes little sense, since the weight of the shielding needed for the maneuver is greater than the propellant the fusion-driven rocket needs to slow down. In other words, you simply turn the thing around backwards and aim the rocket toward the direction you want to slow down in, refire it, and it slows the craft down. By the way, far less than a G, about 0.2 Gs when this thing fires off. Very, very easy on the human body. Very easy on the equipment. Won't strip the solar panels off the outside. This FDR, as they call it, is one of 10 projects to get Stage 2 funding from NASA's program called the Advanced Concepts Program. It's a $600,000 award, which will provide the proof of concept FDR system over the next 18 months. Sandia Labs originally talked about this several years ago. They noticed that when these electrical charges are put on the bands, there's also a field that is generated around it, and there was a comment that it may even be a dimensional motor. Don't know what that means, but might have an effect on time itself. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting that, you know, maybe we have the makings of a time machine on our hands. It's hard to say. Hard to say. Let's take a quick break before we enter into our third hour at X Squared Radio. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
Really care for music, do you? Well,
Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I am your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future, and the results are always positive. We appreciate you being part of the program tonight. Remember that our phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. And 530-413-9537 anywhere else on planet or off planet. If you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. In this hour, I'd like to talk about Comet Ison. Lots going on in the news, but I want you to keep things in perspective. You'll remember that when Comet Elenin came around, many people from different television programs, Alex Jones and different radio programs like Coast to Coast, called me and asked me for my analysis on Elenin, and I gave it, and it was quite opposite of what you were hearing in the press and even in the non-mainstream press. Elenin was an extinction event, extinction-level event, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I told you what was going to happen with the Comet Elenin, and it played out exactly as I analyzed it. So maybe I have a little credibility when it comes to analyzing these things for you. No, I'm not an astronomer. I am a mathematician, and I look at these things for their beauty and their complexity, and certainly comets fall into that category. Early indications from students who have been processing data from NASA's Swift satellite estimate the comet to be around 3 miles in diameter. Some of you have erroneously heard that the comet was going to be 3, 4, 5, 6 times the diameter of Earth. Nonsense. They reached this conclusion by observing the amount of ice and dust emitted from Ison's surface as it falls through space toward the sun. This is a good way of measuring it. Like all comets, Ison is a clump of frozen gases mixed with dust. It could also be a lot of water. Often, by gases, I mean methane, CO2, things like that. Often described as dirty snowballs, comets emit gas and dust whenever they venture near enough to the sun that the icy material transforms from a solid to a gas. We call it sublimation. It's the same thing your dashboard does under the sun, and that's why you buy those funky little silver shields to put underneath your windshield. Because your dashboard, the vinyl and the formaldehyde that it takes to make that skin and the foam underneath the skin to make up your dashboard, sublimates. It goes directly from solid to a gas, and then it deposits itself on your windshield, and that's why you have to wash the inside of your windshield from time to time to get that smeary stuff off of there. Well, as these comets sublimate, it is a little bit like the movie, you know, Deep Impact or Armageddon, where the surface absorbs infrared radiation because it's not actually hot in space. But the infrared radiation that the sun puts out is absorbed by the surface of the comet on the sunward side. And those gases begin to evaporate off, going from solid to gas directly. Well, when it does that, it goes, it expands at least 1,000 times its volume. So in essence, you have a jet, you have a retro rocket. And these jets are powered by the sublimating ice. They also release dust and bits of rock, which reflect the sunlight and brightens the comet up where we can see it. Typically, a comet's water content remains frozen until it comes within about 3 times Earth's distance to the sun. It's about, 80,000 miles or so. While Swift's UVOT cannot detect water directly, the molecule quickly breaks into hydrogen atoms and hydroxyl, that's the OH molecules, when exposed to ultraviolet sunlight. The UVOT detects light emitted by hydroxyl and other important molecular fragments, as well as sunlight reflected from the dust. And so that's how we're able to pick this stuff up. Now, the January 30th UVOT observations revealed that ISON was shedding about 112,000 pounds of dust, or about two-thirds the mass of an unfueled space shuttle, every minute. By contrast, the comet was producing only about 130 pounds of water every minute, or about 4 times the amount flowing out of a residential sprinkler system. Not much, okay? 130 pounds is just not that much water. Water weighs about 8.8 pounds per gallon. So, you know, do the math. You got about 40 gallons of water there, if that. So the mismatch we detect between the amount of dust and water produced tells us that ISON's water sublimation is not yet powering its jets because the comet is still too far from the sun. It's just not getting enough energy to boil off water. Other more volatile materials that have much lower boiling temperature, like carbon dioxide, which I think is somewhere around 87 degrees below zero, or carbon monoxide ice, evaporate at greater distances and are now fueling ISON's activity. Water, as you know, boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, about 300 degrees hotter than carbon dioxide or methane. At the time, the comet was 375 million miles from Earth, about 460 million miles from the sun. It's still out there a ways. ISON was a magnitude 15.7 on the astronomical brightness scale. Compare that to, say, the star Arcturus, which is somewhere around a 1.5. The more negative you go, the brighter it is. Or about 5,000 times fainter than the threshold of human vision. That's why you need the UVOT to be able to see it. Similar levels of activity were observed in February, and the team plans additional UVOT observations. So we still haven't changed our ideas on that. While the water and dust production rates are relatively uncertain because of the comet's faintness, they can be used to estimate the size of the icy body. Comparing the amount of gas needed for a normal comet to blow off dust at the rate observed for ISON, the scientists estimate that the nucleus is roughly 3 miles across, a typical size for a comet. This assumes that only the fraction of the surface most directly exposed to the sun, which is about 10% of the total surface area, is actually producing the jets. If that's not the case, if comet ISON is oddly shaped and only a small side, in other words, suppose it's a long cylindrical kind of comet, which it could be, or some kind of shard, and only the side that's facing the sun is actually off-gassing, then we could be wrong. And ISON could be much, much larger than what we think. Could be as much as 6 miles across or 10 miles across. But it's not going to be much smaller than that. An important question is whether ISON will continue to brighten at the same pace once water evaporation becomes the dominant source of jets. In other words, does it have water in it, or is it all carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and methane? We don't really know. Will the comet sizzle or fizzle? That's what everybody's thinking. Now, That being said, not many people are worried about this comet, and I'm not so sure they shouldn't be. You remember when Elonin showed up, we had all kinds of agencies, civilian agencies, all worried about this, and a lot of commentators came on and said it was going to hit Earth and it was going to come closer to us than what the original trajectory was estimated to be. It didn't. It didn't get anywhere close to us, and it fizzled like a bad breath out there in space and went away. This one is going to be a little bit different. Its hyperbolic orbit is going to bring it very tight to the sun, much tighter than you think, about 750,000 miles. Not millions of miles, 750,000 miles from the sun. This is going to get really close to the corona of the sun. Now, there are some things here that come into play that no one is talking about yet. It's still a long way out there, but I'm going to plant it for you. If you've got any comments on it, you want to write me, bagnew@x2-radio, that's fine. But this important question is looked at as entertainment, okay, by the astronomical community. What they want to see is a bright show. Past comets have failed to live up to expectations. Once they reach the inner solar system, and only observations over the next few months will improve our knowledge of how ISON will perform on stage. That's the way they're looking at it. This is a very large comet. 3 miles across is not typical, not if it's got a lot of water in it, not if there's anything other than dust in it, and not if it's irregularly shaped. Although observers say it's not violently off-gassing yet, hence the absence of a real tail, rest assured it will off-gas. It will come within 750,000 miles of the sun, and it will be off-gassing like a steaming bomb. So two things are going to happen. Two things are going to happen. The Roche limit, or the Roche limit, it depends on how you pronounce that, will be skirted. In other words, the Roche limit is approximately one diameter away from most gravitational bodies, depending on their density. And in this limit, a smaller gravitational body, not like a solid ball of iron, but something held together by gravity, like dirt or water or frozen gas, the internal gravity of that smaller body is shaded or overcome by the gravity of the larger body, causing the head to break up into numerous corporeal parts that will not have tremendous integrity. These large pieces will not travel in exactly the same path. Okay, we saw this when we saw Shoemaker break up. You remember that? Remember watching the satellite imagery of and the telescopic imagery of when Shoemaker broke apart into about 12 large pieces, and those pieces went into Jupiter, and we watched them one by one explode in the atmosphere of Jupiter? Well, the head came apart because the gravity of Jupiter overcame the internal gravity of the comet, breaking it apart into 12 large pieces. This is going to come in really close to the sun. Some of these pieces will fall into the sun, and some will go around the sun like the hyperbolic orbit dictates. They'll slingshot, as it were. Now, the second thing is that these pieces are going to be spinning like pinwheels as the steam rockets out of holes within the large pieces. The retro rocket activity will propel these pieces in all direction like a bunch of scalded cats. That's why the paths of comets are so impossible to predict. They are wild. So the question remains, as this thing does a hyperbolic slingshot around the sun, it's going to come in on a fairly predictable path. It's going to be off-gassing like mad. You will be able to see it during daylight. In other words, you look up at the blue sky, shade the sun with your hand, and you should be able to see Comet ISON in the daytime sky. It's going to be really, really big. The head of this, as it's off-gassing, will be enormous, and the tail will be hundreds and thousands of miles long. It'll be easy to see. Now, the question is, will Mars be hit? One of the questions people raise is, will Mars be hit? It's not likely, as the nearest ISON will get will be an estimated 6.7 million miles from Mars. But remember, this is an estimate. And right now, this comet is about 500 million miles out there. So we do not have enough information yet to track it. It's sort of like predicting where your bullet is going to hit when all you have is a one-inch ruler to measure the angle of your rifle barrel. You need a little bit more resolution. You need a longer barrel in order to make these predictions. These predictions are only going to be an estimate because this thing is going to be off-gassing like a jet. Now, a lot of people say, well, is it going to explode? Is it just going to boil away? No, it won't. Because remember, that infrared energy hits the sunward side of these ice chunks. Only that side is going to be off-gassing. And remember, the instant this stuff off-gasses, it is refreezing the surface of that comet. It's sort of like when you step out of the swimming pool in Phoenix, Arizona at night. It may be 100 degrees outside, but it's so dry that that water evaporates so fast off your body, it will send you into hypothermia and shivering. You'll be jumping into the hot tub, even though it's 100 degrees outside. Why? Because there's no infrared energy hitting your skin. There's only the water evaporating off, and that recools the body, which is exactly what happens to comets. So based on ISON's orbit, astronomers think the comet is going to make its first ever trip through the inner solar system, and before beginning its long fall toward the sun, the comet resided in what we call the Oort comet cloud. It's a vast shell, probably has a trillion icy bodies in it, that extends from the outer reaches of the planetary system to about a third of the distance, to the star nearest the sun. Formerly designated C2012S1, ISON, the comet was discovered on September 21st, 2012, by Russian astronomer Vitaly Nevsky and Artyom Novichonok, using a telescope at the International Science Optical Network located near Kislovsk. Now, that's where they got the name ISON, International Scientific Optical Network. That's ISON. The first of several intriguing observing opportunities occurred on October 1st when the inbound comet passes about 6.7 million miles from Mars. During this close encounter, ISON will be observable to NASA and ESA spacecraft now working at Mars. Now, the interesting thing about this is that pass will be 6.7 miles. But remember, this is a hyperbolic orbit. It's going to come in, it's going to slingshot around the sun, and it's going to go right back out. Okay? 58 days later, on November 28th, ISON will make a sweltering passage around the sun. The comet will approach within about 730,000 miles of its visible surface, which classifies ISON as a sun-grazing comet. In late November, its icy material will furiously sublimate and release torrents of dust as the surface erodes under the sun's fierce heat, all as sun monitoring satellites look on. Around this time, the comet may become bright enough to glimpse just by holding your hand up and blocking the sun's glare. Scientists estimate that as much as 10% of the comet's diameter may erode away. But this is not going to devastate it. As I said, it will recool the comet. In fact, this off-gassing, this cloud of gas that comes off as a tail will shield the comet from the infrared radiation from the sun, just as though just as clouds shield you from the sun's intensity when you go outside. Following ISON's solar encounter, the comet will depart the sun and it will move toward Earth, appearing in the evening twilight through December. It will swing past Earth on December 26th, approaching within 39.9 million miles. That's much, much closer than Elenin did. And remember, if this is 3 miles across and it stays together and it loses only 10% of its mass, it's still going to be huge. Still going to be huge. If it breaks apart into 12 chunks, it's going to be interesting. If it breaks apart into 200 or 300 chunks, and each one of those chunks is spinning like a pinwheel, it's going to miss us on that pass. But remember, Earth goes around the sun. And a few months later, we're going to pass right back through this. Whether we look back on ISON as a comet of the century or as an overhyped cosmic dud remains to be seen. But astronomers are planning to learn the most they can about this unusual visitor, no matter what happens. Now, this is by no means the end of the story. And this is what I would like to leave with you tonight. The comet will likely be shattered into a few hundred smaller chunks, and one of the most massive tails ever seen by modern man. This may be water vapor. It could harbor billions of cubic yards of frozen methane. If Earth passes through any of this debris field, it will be eventful to say the least. Highly charged methane can ignite when encountering oxygen in the atmosphere, creating a flaming hurricane. It has happened before. It is recorded as a very probable cause in history of the Great Chicago Fire on October 8, 1871, that devastated 5 states simultaneously. Now, this is condensed from a larger article, but if you'll remember, the Chicago Fire was originally thought to be caused when Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked a lantern over in the barn. Utter nonsense. In 1843, remember this happened in 1871. In 1843, there appeared one of the greatest comets of history. The Great Comet of 1843, formerly designated C-1843-D1 and 1843-1, was discovered on February 5th, 1843. Remember, we didn't have really great telescopes like we have now. And rapidly brightened. It was a member of the Crutes Sun Grazers, a family of comets resulting from the breakup of a parent comet, X1106C1. Broke into multiple fragments in about 1106. These comets pass extremely close to the sun within a few solar radii, and this is why they often become very, very bright. Well, 1843 D1 moved rapidly toward an incredibly close perihelion of less than 830,000 kilometers on February 27, 1843, at which time it could be seen in broad daylight, just a degree away from the sun. It swung around and passed close to Earth on March 3rd, 1843. It seemed to manifest its greatest brilliance the following day. It was last observed on April 19th, 1843. At that time, this comet had passed closer to the sun than any other known object. The American Journal of Science and the New York Tribune devoted special sections to this comet at the time. You could say that comet fever was pandemic. The Great Comet of 1843, still unnamed, developed a tail over 2 astronomical units in length, almost 200 million miles long, the longest known comet tail. Measurements in 1996 showed that Comet Hayutake's tail was almost twice as long. In 1857, an anonymous German astrologer predicted that a comet would strike the Earth on June 13th of that year. The impending catastrophe became the talk of all Europe. The French astronomer Jacques Babinet tried to reassure people by stating that a collision between Earth and a comet would do no harm. He compared the impact to a railway train hitting a fly. His words apparently had little effect. The Paris correspondent for the American journal Harper's Weekly wrote, "Women have miscarried. Crops have been neglected. Wills have been made. Comet-proof suits of clothing have been invented. A cometary life insurance company, premiums payable in advance, has been created. All because an almanac maker thought proper to insert under the week commencing June 13th, about this time, expect a comet." Well, let's back up a minute here to 1826. In 1826, Comet 3D Biela was discovered by Wilhelm von Biela. It was become known as Comet Biela or Biela's Comet. This comet had been first seen in 1772 by Charles Messier and again in 1805 by Jean-Louis Pons. It was von Biela who discovered it in 1826. Its perihelion approach on February 27th, calculated its orbit, discovering it to be periodic with a period of 6.6 years, which is why it was named after him and not Messier or Pons. It was only the third comet at the time found to be periodic after the famous comets Halley and Encke. French astronomer M. Damoiseau subsequently calculated its path and announced that on its next return, the comet would cross the orbit of the Earth within 20,000 miles of its track, and only about 1 month before the Earth would arrive at the same spot. Remember, it had a very long tail. When the comet came in 1832, the Earth did indeed miss it by 1 month. It returned again in 1839, 1846, and its 1846 appearance, the comet was observed to have broken up into two pieces. It was observed again in 1852 with the two parts being 1.5 million miles apart. Each part had a head and a tail of its own. The comet did not come in 1852, in 1859, or in 1866. The Edinburgh Review notes about this strange state of affairs. The puzzled astronomers were left in a state of tantalizing uncertainty as to what had become of it. At the beginning of the year, 1866, this feeling of bewilderment gained expression in the annual report on the Council of the Royal Astronomical Society. The matter continued, nevertheless, in the same state of provoking uncertainty for another 6 years. The third period of the perihelion passage had then passed, and nothing had been seen of the missing luminary. But on the night of November 27th, 1872, night watchers were startled by a sudden and very magnificent display of falling stars or meteors, of which there had been no previous forecast. The meteors were radiating from the part of the sky where the comet had been expected to cross in September. In other words, the trajectory was the same and the Earth intersected it, but the velocity was somewhat altered. The American Journal of Science said they fell like snowflakes. Professor Olmsted, a mathematician at Yale University, estimated 34,640 shooting stars per hour. The New York Journal of Commerce wrote that no philosopher or scholar has ever recorded an event like this. The meteors became known as the Andromedids, or the Belids, as it seemed apparent that they indicated the death of the comet. The meteors were seen again on subsequent occasions for the rest of the 19th century, but have now faded away. Is that all there is to that? Well, maybe not. As it happens, on Sunday, the 8th of October in the year 1871, at 9:30 in the evening, events occurred which caused the death of hundreds of human beings and the destruction of vast amounts of property across three different states of the American Union, sending millions of people into fits of the wildest alarm and terror. The following passages are extracted from the History of the Great Conflagration, 1871. The summer of 1871 had been excessively dry. The moisture seemed to be evaporated out of the air. And on the Sunday above, named, the atmospheric conditions all through the Northwest were of the most peculiar character. The writer was living at the time in Minnesota, hundreds of miles from the scene of the disasters, and he could never forget the condition of things. There was a parched, combustible, inflammable, furnace-like feeling in the air that was really alarming. It felt as if there were needed but a match, a spark, to cause a worldwide explosion. It was weird and unnatural. I have never seen nor felt anything like it before or since. Those who experienced it bear me out in these statements. At that hour, 9:30 in the evening, at apparently the same moment, at points hundreds of miles apart, in three different states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois, fires of the most peculiar and devastating kind broke out. So far as we know, by spontaneous combustion. In Wisconsin, on its eastern borders, in a heavily timbered country near Lake Michigan, a region embracing 400 square miles, extending north from Brown County and containing Peshtigo, Manistee, Holland, and numerous villages on the shores of Green Bay, was swept bare by an absolute whirlwind of flame. There were 750 people killed outright, besides great numbers of the wounded, maimed, and burned who died afterward. More than $3 million worth of property damage was destroyed. At sundown, there was a lull in the wind and a comparative stillness. For 2 hours, there were no signs of danger. But at a few minutes after 9:00, and by a singular coincidence, precisely the time at which the Chicago fire commenced, the people of the village heard a terrible roar. It was that of a tornado crushing through the forests. Instantly, the heavens were illuminated with a terrible glare. The sky, which had been so dark a moment before, burst into clouds of flame. A spectator of the terrible scene says the fire did not come upon them gradually from burning trees and other objects to the windward, but the first notice they had of it was a whirlwind of flame in great clouds from above the tops of the trees, which fell upon and entirely enveloped everything. The poor people inhaled it or the intensely hot air and fell down dead. This is verified by the appearance of many of the corpses. They were found dead in the roads and open spaces where there were no visible marks of fire nearby and not a trace of burning on their body or clothing. At Sugar Rush, which is an extended clearing in some places 4 miles in width, corpses were found in the open road, between fences, only slightly burned. No mark of fire was upon them. They lay there as if asleep. The phenomenon seemed to explain the fact that so many were killed in compact masses. They seemed to have huddled together, what were evidently regarded at the moment the safest places, away from buildings, trees, and other inflammable materials. And there, they just died together. Much has been said of the intense heat of the fires which destroyed Peshtigo, Menucaune, Williamsville. But all that has been said can give the stranger but a faint conception of the reality. The heat has been compared to that engendered by a flame concentrated on an object by a blowpipe. But even that would not account for some of the phenomenon. For instance, we have in our possession a copper cent taken from a pocket of a dead man in Peshtigo Sugar Bush, which will illustrate our point. The scent has been partially fused, but it retains its round form, and the inscription upon it is legible. Others in the same pocket were partially melted, and yet the clothing and the body of the man were not even singed. We do not know in what way to account for this, unless, as it is asserted by some, the tornado and fire were accompanied by electrical phenomena. It is the universal testimony that the prevailing idea among the people was that the last day had come. Accustomed as they were to fire, nothing like it had ever been known. They could not give no other interpretation to this ominous roar, this bursting of the sky with flame, and this dropping out of fire out of the very heavens, consuming everything it touched. No two give a like description of the great tornado as it smote and devoured the village. It seemed as if the fiery fiends of hell had been loosened, one said. It came in great sheeted flames from heaven, said another. There was a pitiless rain of fire and sand. The atmosphere was all afire. Some speak of great balls of fire, unrolling and shooting forth in streams. The fire leaped over roofs and trees and ignited whole streets at one time. No one could stand before its blast. It was a race with death, above, behind, and before them. The heat increased so rapidly as things got well afire that when about 400 feet from them, from the bridge and nearest building, I obliged to lie down behind a log that was aground in about 2 feet of water, and by going underwater now and then and holding my head close to the water behind the log, I managed to breathe. There were a dozen others behind the same log. If I had succeeded in crossing the river and had gone among the buildings on the other side, probably I should have been lost, as many were. In Michigan, one Allison Weaver, near Port Huron, determined to remain to protect, if possible, some mill property of which he had charge. He knew the fire was coming and dug himself a shallow well or pit, made a thick plank cover made of the slabs from the sawmill to place over it, and thus prepared to bide the conflagration. Here's what he said. This is his testimony. He filled it nearly full of water, took care to saturate the ground around it for a distance of several rods. Going to the mill, he dragged out a 4-inch thick plank, sawed it in two, and saw that the parts tightly covered the mouth of the little well he had dug. I calculated it would be touch and go, he said, but it was the best I could do. At midnight, he had everything arranged, and the roaring then was awful to hear. The clearing was 10 to 12 acres in extent. In other words, this is an area where the trees had been cut down. Only stumps were there. 10 to 12 acres. And Weaver said that for 2 hours before the fire reached him, there was a constant flight across the ground of small animals. As he rested a moment from giving the house another wetting down, a horse dashed into the open at full speed and made for the house. Weaver could see him tremble and shake with excitement and terror, and felt a pity for him. After a moment, the animal gave utterance to a snort of dismay, ran 2 or 3 times around the house, and then shot off into the woods like a rocket. Not long after this fire came, Weaver stood by his well, ready for the emergency, yet curious to see the breaking in of the flames. The roaring increased in volume. The air became oppressive. A cloud of dust and cinders came showering down, and he could see the flames in the trees. It didn't run along the ground or leap from tree to tree, but it came on like a tornado, a sheet of flame reaching from the earth to the tops of the trees. As it struck the clearing, he jumped into his well and closed over the planks. He could no longer see, but he could hear. He says that the flames made no halt whatever, or ceased their roaring for an instant. But he hardly got the opening closed before the house and mill were burning tinder, and both were down in 5 minutes flat. The smoke came down upon him powerfully, and his den was so hot he could hardly breathe. He knew that the planks above him were on fire, but remembering their thickness, he waited till the roaring of the flames had died away, and then, with his head and his hands, turned them over and put our fire out by dashing up water on them with his hands. Although it was a cold night, and the water had at first chilled him, the heat gradually warmed him up until he felt quite comfortable. He remained in his den until daylight, frequently turning over the planks and putting out the fire, and then, when the worst had passed, the earth around was on fire in spots. House and mill gone, leaves, brush, logs swept away as if shaved off and swept with a broom, and nothing, nothing but soot and ashes were to be seen. Even the stumps burnt to the ground. In Williamson's Mills, there was a large but shallow well on the premises belonging to Mr. Boorman. The people then cut off by the flames and wild with terror and thinking they would find safety in the water, leaped into this well. The relentless fury of the flames drove them pell-mell into the pit to struggle with each other and die, some by drowning, others by fire and suffocation. None escaped. 32 bodies were found there. They were in every imaginable position, but the contortions of their limbs and the agonizing expressions of their faces told the whole story. The same thing happened in Uniontown, Wisconsin. And in Chicago itself, buildings made of stone and steel, burnt to the ground in 5 minutes flat. This fire, it is reported, probably was caused by the cometary tail. What we're talking about here is a giant methane tail of a comet. Now, in our books, The Arc of Millions of Years series, 2,000 pages on the origin and destiny of the Earth, and the events leading up to 2012, we do talk about a conflagration. Originally, the Maya had predicted that the conflagration would probably be caused by a solar flare. The solar flare would be exacerbated by the gravitational pull of the galactic plane and the Earth's alignment with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. We know that December 21st, 2012 came and went, and we didn't see much of that. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't there. That means that we're in it now. We're moving through it. And all I can tell you is that it's a possibility that we could pass through this tail. Would it be this year? Would it be next year? It's difficult to say. But the tail on Comet Ison will rival the cometary tail seen by anything we have seen in the past. Of that, I am sure. We have about 7 months to bear this out, if I am right or I am wrong. But you can go back to this archive and you can share it with your friends as much as is possible. And we'll discuss it from time to time as we get closer and closer to November, when Ison will make its biggest show. As it goes around the sun, it will come close to Earth. And maybe some of those pieces and maybe the tail itself will lay on Earth's orbital path. We're familiar with the Geminids. We're familiar with other small meteorites that we see on an annual basis like clockwork. This may be a new one. This giant tail may not just carry carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. It may carry methane. It may carry water vapor. We may see more activity from this. And many people are saying, and could it possibly be, the sign of the Son of Man? We're at the end of the age, just like Jesus said. We're at the apex of the two ages, Aquarius and Pisces, just as the Maya said. I would say that if you ever thought about getting your life together, raising your vibrational energies, thinking about the peace of the earth, maybe harboring a little less envy and a little less hatred for those around you, this would be a good time for it. Keep listening to X Squared Radio. We'll keep bringing you, you know, the best, most positive message that we can about it. Hope you enjoyed tonight's program. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.